Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, the right conversation at the right time can change everything. It's how we find solutions at work, how we comfort friends, how we fall in love. Conversations connect us. We evolved to be social, but sometimes talking to each other feels stressful, even miserable, says Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist with the New York Times, Charles Duhigg. His new book looks to science as well as stories from agents in the CIA, writers on the Big Bang Theory, and psychologists at NASA that explain why conversations can go so wrong and what we can do to get them right. The book is called Super Communicators: How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. And Charles Duhigg joins me now. Hello there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Congratulations on the book, by the way. It seems like it's everywhere at the moment. Everywhere you turn, people are suddenly talking about super communicators. So you've really coined a phrase.
Thanks. Well, I hope that it's not just talking about it, but actually having better conversations too.
Yeah.
Which is the real prize.
Well, you describe a super communicator as that person you call when you're having a bad day, and you're a writer for the New York Times. So do people look to you for the right words after something terrible happens?
Well, they, some of them do, but it's not because of my way with words. It's really because of what I've learned about asking the right questions and proving to people that I'm listening to them. You know, one of the things that I thought when I started researching this book was that super communicators would be these really charismatic folks or these really charming people. But it turns out that's not actually true. You know, some super communicators are charismatic and others are curmudgeonly. Some are extroverts, some are introverts. It's not that this is something we're born with. It's just a set of skills that once we learn to use, allows us to really connect with other people. It helps us understand how conversations function.
And that term super communicators, is that a nod to the fact that actually good communication is a superpower?
It's exactly right. I mean, for Homo sapiens, communication has always been our superpower, right? It's the thing that allowed us as a species to succeed so well and to build families and villages and then towns and countries, to learn things and communicate that knowledge without the person we're talking to having to experience the learning themselves. Communication has always been our superpower. And what we know is that our brain has evolved to be really good at it if we're taught the right skills. If we're taught the right skills, then we make those into habits very, very quickly, and we connect with anyone.
But why should we have to be taught that? It's so innately human. Shouldn't talking to each other be easy instead of something that we have to work at?
Absolutely. And I wish that it was, right? And many of our conversations are easy. It's amazing how many people we can talk to every day. Yeah. But I think you and me and everyone listening, there's probably a conversation you had that you wanted to go really well that didn't, right? It was awkward, or you didn't know what to say, or maybe you got into a fight that, looking back on it, you think to yourself, gosh, I really could have avoided that. And what we know is that communication and conversations, they are sometimes easy, but there's so many choices we have to make, so many variables that we have to decide on, that understanding, thinking a little bit about how conversations work, that's what makes us better at connecting with other people.
How common is it for people to be at cross purposes when they're talking to each other? One person is looking for an empathetic conversation, and the other one is just offering solutions.
Yeah, that happens all the time. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is I fell into that pattern with my wife, where I'd come home from work after a long day and I would complain about my day, and she would offer me this good advice. And instead of being able to hear what she was saying, I would get even more upset, right? And say, why aren't you supporting me?
Yeah.
And so I went to all these researchers and I asked them, what's going on there? If I'm such a great communicator, a professional communicator, as a journalist, why do I keep falling into this pattern? And they said, well, look, here's what we've learned in the last decade. We tend to think of discussions as being about one thing, but actually every discussion is made up of different kinds of conversations. And they tend to fall into one of three buckets. There's these practical conversations where we're solving problems or we're making plans together. Then there's emotional conversations where I might tell you what I'm feeling and I don't want you to solve my feelings. As you pointed out, I want you to empathize. And then there's social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other in society. And they said, what we've learned is that if you're having a different kind of conversation as the person you're talking to, you won't really hear each other. So when I was coming home, I was having an emotional conversation and my wife responded with a practical conversation. And both of those are legitimate kinds of conversations. But because we weren't having the same kind of conversation at the same moment, we couldn't really connect. And that's one of the things that super communicators know how to do. They know how to recognize what kind of conversation is happening right now.
Yeah. And so the first step is to connect. Well, the first step in connecting with others is to make sure you're both having the same kind of conversation. Is that an explicit pre-conversation?
Sometimes it can be, right? When I come home now, my wife and I start complaining, my wife will often say, well, do you want me to like suggest solutions or do you want me just to listen to you vent? which I, of course, kind of appreciate her asking. Huh. But sometimes it's just as simple as asking a question, right? And there's some kinds of questions that are more powerful than others. These are known as deep questions. And they ask about your values or your beliefs or your experiences. And it can be as simple as meeting someone who's a doctor. And instead of asking them, oh, where do you practice medicine? Saying, oh, what made you decide to become a doctor?
Yeah.
Like, what do you love about your job? That's a question that asks someone or invites someone to reveal something meaningful about themselves. And when they do that, they tend to tell you what kind of conversation they want to have. Hmm. They might say, oh, you know, I became a doctor because it's a steady job. They're in a practical mindset. Or the same person might say, you know, I became a doctor because I saw my dad get sick when I was a kid. And I was so impressed with the physicians who helped heal him. That's more of an emotional conversation, an emotional mindset.
There's a story in the book about a CIA agent who was pretty good at meeting people where they are in a conversation and getting on the same page. Can you tell us what his secret
was?
Yeah,
absolutely. And what's funny is that at first he wasn't good at it at all. You know, this is a guy named Jim Lawler. He's now retired from the CIA. But when he first became a CIA officer, they sent him over to Europe to recruit spies. And he was terrible at the job. He was miserable at it. He would go to parties and try and talk people up and they would say things like, I know you're trying to recruit me as a spy. If you don't stop, I'm going to report you to the authorities and you're going to get deported. And so Lawler was pretty afraid that he's going to get fired. And his bosses told him, you're probably going to get fired. And then this one woman came to town and he spent months trying to recruit her. He eventually told her he worked for the CIA. He asked if she would work with him. She was worked in the foreign ministry of a government back in the Middle East. And she said, no, I can't help you. They murder people. They execute people in my country for doing that. So he tells his bosses that he can't close the deal. And they say, you're definitely going to get fired. And so he asks this woman if she'll have one more meal with him. And they go out to dinner. And she's in kind of a glum mood because she's about to go home. And she's kind of disappointed in herself. She'd come to Europe to try and figure out how she fights this religious repression that's happening at home. Mm. These radicals who had just taken over the government. And she hasn't figured anything out. And so Lawler, during dinner, he tries to cheer her up. He tells her funny stories. He reminisces about when they went sightseeing together. And of course, it doesn't work. She's glum. And so eventually he thinks to himself, look, there's nothing I can do here. This woman is definitely not going to work for me. She's not going to work for the CIA. And so he just starts to be honest with her. And he starts telling her, I understand why you're feeling down, why you feel disappointed in yourself. I've worked my entire life to try and become a CIA officer and I get this job and I show up and I discover that I'm terrible at it. I'm so disappointed in myself. And it's at this moment when he's having the same kind of conversation that she is, that she finally is able to hear him. And she says, I think I can do this. Huh. I think I can help you. And she went on to become one of the best sources of information in the Middle East over the next 20 years. But it's only because he authentically matched the kind of conversation that she was having that she felt like she could trust him.
If you just tuned in, by the way, I'm talking to Charles Duhigg, a journalist for the New York Times, and his book is called Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Super communicators tend to ask more questions than other people. In fact, 10 to 20 times as many questions as everyone else. But we don't notice that they're asking these questions sometimes. And why is that, Charles?
Well, some of the questions are just questions designed to invite us in, right? They ask things like, oh, what'd you make of that? Or what'd you say next? They're invitations for us to participate in this conversation. And then some of those questions that I mentioned are those deep questions, right? Asking people, instead of about the facts of their life, asking them how they feel about their life. I do this with my kids all the time, in fact. You know, I have teenagers at home, and as many of your listeners probably are aware themselves, having teens at home, I would ask them all these things about, you know, how was your day? Good. Did you learn anything at school? No. Did you have fun? No. Right. It was all these one word answers. And so then instead of asking them about the facts of their day, I started asking them how they felt about things. You know, I noticed that you hung out with your friend Jasper today. It seems like you really like him. What do you admire about Jasper? When you ask those questions, when you invite people to show you how they're an expert on their own life, on how they feel about the life, their life, about how they see the world, that's when they start talking. And my kids would tell me these amazing things about themselves and their friends. But it's only because I asked them the right questions, because I asked them not about the facts of what had happened that day, but how they made sense, how they felt about their day.
How did NASA figure out which astronauts were faking good communication and emotional intelligence and which ones were actually good at it?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories from the book, because in the early 1980s, NASA had this basic problem, which is they were going to start sending people into space for 6 months or 12 months. And it turns out if you send a bunch of people into space for 6 or 12 months, they have to be good at emotional intelligence. Yeah. Otherwise, they're going to get on each other's nerves immediately. But the problem for NASA was, by the time you make it to the final rounds of interviewing to be an astronaut, you're fantastic, right? You know what to say to every question. You are smart. You are polished. You know how to fake emotional intelligence as good as anyone out there. And you can fake it for a week, for an interview. You can't fake it for 6 months, though. And so NASA had to come up with a new way to interview its candidates to figure out which of them actually had emotional intelligence. And one of the guys, a psychologist who worked for the agency, he came up with a solution. He changed entirely how he did his interviews. What he would do is he would walk into the interview room holding a big stack of papers, and then he would spill them as if by on an accident. And then he would laugh, this big boisterous laugh. I'm such a goof. And he would pay close attention to how the candidate reacted. Because everyone laughed back, right? We know that we're supposed to laugh when someone else laughs. That's basic social politeness. But some candidates would chuckle. They'd go, that's so silly. Let me give you a hand. And other candidates, they would match his laughter. And they'd go, that's really silly. Let me give you a hand picking those up. And what he knew was that the candidates who matched him, who matched his energy and his intensity, they were the ones with emotional intelligence. Because we've all been in that situation when we walk in and we make a mistake and then we overreact to the mistake. And some people make it clear that we've overreacted. They're cool and polished themselves. And other people, they try and make us feel okay. Like that overreaction isn't that big a deal. Like laughing this big boisterous laugh after you spilled papers, that's something anyone could do. Those are people with emotional intelligence. Those are people who are super communicators. And the same is true kind of throughout life, right? That the people we like the most, the people who communicate best with us, they're the ones who show us that they want to connect with us. Mm. Showing that you want to connect is the most important step in actually making that connection become real.
And you say that studies show for us to connect with each other, we have to prove we're really listening. How do we do that?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, particularly in conflict conversations, when we disagree with each other, when we're having a little bit of tension, there's always a suspicion in the back of our mind that the other person, they aren't actually listening to me. They're just waiting their turn to speak. Yeah. Right. And so one of the things that we know helps that conversation a lot is this activity known as looping for understanding, proving that I'm listening. And there's three steps to looping for understanding. The first is to ask a question, preferably a deep question if you can. The second step is to repeat back after the person answers the question, repeat back what you heard them say in your own words. Show them that you're paying attention. Show them that you're processing what they said. And then step number three, and this is the one we usually forget, is ask them if you got it right. Because the reason why that's so powerful is that sometimes we don't get it right, right? Sometimes we misunderstood, and this gives them a chance to clarify. But even if we did get it right, by asking them if we got it right, we're asking them for permission to acknowledge that we're listening. And one of the things that we know happens, this is hardwired into our brain by evolution, is that when we believe someone is listening closely to us, when they prove to us that they're listening closely, we become more likely to listen to them in return. And so that's how we connect with folks, even when we have some conflict or tension with them, is we prove that we're listening. And then we're both more likely to understand each other.
Do the rules change now we're doing so much business on Zoom or on screens?
Yeah, a little bit, right? One of my favorite examples of this is that about 100 years ago, when telephones first became popular, there were all these papers that said, oh, people will never have real conversations on the phone. Like, if you can't see each other, you're never going to be able to have a real conversation.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is at that time, they were actually right. If you look at those early transcripts of people with the first users of telephones, what you see is that they use them basically as like telegraphs. They would like send, you know, orders, grocery orders to each other or stock purchases. But of course, by the time you and I and everyone listening was in middle school, we could talk on the phone for 7 hours a night and have some of the most important conversations of our life. And that's because we learned how to use phones. And when we're talking on the phone, without even realizing it, oftentimes we'll over-enunciate a little bit more. We'll put more emotion into our voice because we know that the other person can't see us. Mm. We have evolved. We've learned how to use telephones. And the truth of the matter is that the same thing is going to happen with Zoom and texting and emojis and sending emails. We will learn how to use these forms of communication. Our kids are already learning it. But for the rest of us, it's a relatively new phenomena. And so there's some missteps along the way. But absolutely, we will be able to have as real conversations over Zoom or over the telephone as we do face to face. It's just a matter of learning how to use that channel.
You have some great examples in the book. I think we'll let people read about the Big Bang Theory conversation, but I love the story about how gun safety and gun rights advocates behaved so differently online rather than in person. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So this was an experiment that was done a number of years ago where they brought together all these gun rights advocates and all these gun control activists, and they taught them how to have this conversation, this looping for understanding, how to prove they're listening to each other. And it worked. These folks didn't change each other's minds, but that wasn't the goal. The goal was just to see if they could have a civil conversation with each other. And so for an entire weekend, they talk to each other. They feel really connected to people who they had been shouting at for years previously.
Yeah.
And then they all go home and they set up a Facebook group to continue the conversation. And within 45 minutes, people are calling each other jackbooted Nazis, right? Like, it all falls apart almost immediately.
Yeah.
And the reason why is a little bit what I was just describing. One of the things that sometimes happens is that we tend to forget that there are different rules for different kinds of communication, right? If I was to tell you, you know, you shouldn't, when you say something sarcastic, they can hear it in your voice, but you shouldn't type something sarcastic in an email because they're going to think you're being serious. They're not going to pick up on the sarcasm. You'll know that that's true. You'll feel that truth. But sometimes when we're moving so fast, we forget that typing online and sending an email is different from talking face-to-face, is different from talking on the phone, is different from sending someone a text. We forget that there's these slightly different rules for different kinds of communication. And when we forget that, everything falls apart. But if we just take a second, if we just remind ourselves, okay, I'm going to send an email, so I have to do it a little bit different than I would if I was picking up the telephone and I was calling this person. If we remind ourselves of those slightly different rules, then our communication becomes much, much better, whether it's online or face-to-face or anything in between.
Most of us have had that experience in a job interview or maybe on a first date where the conversation is clicking and you both know it is and things are easy. Is that, out of interest, is that feeling, is that a physical feeling?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Our brains have evolved. So in any meaningful conversation, like this conversation right now, even though we're not aware of it, our breath patterns have started to match each other. Our heart rates have begun to align. And most importantly, the activity within our brains is becoming more and more similar. And that kind of makes sense when you think about it, because if I describe to you an emotion or an idea, you actually experience that emotion a little bit. You experience that idea. And so what communication is it's our brains becoming, in the words of neurology, neurally entrained, where we begin thinking alike. And it's that thinking alike that allows us to understand each other, that allows us to connect. And the thing is that our brains have evolved to crave that kind of connection. That's why a good conversation feels wonderful, is because you feel like someone is really listening to you. You feel like they really understand you. You feel like you really understand what they're saying. You click. You become neurally entrained. And as I mentioned, communication has been our superpower as a species. Our ancestors millennia ago who lived the longest were the ones who sought out others, who were pro-social, who wanted to build families and communities, because that gave them a huge advantage. Mm. And so that craving for connection, that exists in all of our brains. And when we give into that craving, when we genuinely connect with other people, not only does it feel wonderful, it makes us healthier, it makes us happier, and it makes us more successful.
In fact, there's data behind that too. Harvard's longitudinal survey on happiness, which goes back more than 80 years, says that the key to a happy life is strong connections to people. And so that's possibly the strongest argument there is to work on becoming a super communicator, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The U.S. Surgeon General has said that being lonely is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day for its impact on your health. If you want to live longer, if you want to live happier, then what you should do is you should make at least a handful of real connections with other people. You call up that person you haven't spoken to in a year or so, even though you know it's going to be awkward for the first 5 minutes. But when you have that conversation, when you reconnect with them, when you feel like this is a meaningful relationship, it will bring you so much joy and so much satisfaction in life. It's the most important thing you can do.
What a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for the work you've put into this book and for your time today. Charles Duhigg is author of Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. And thanks for being on RNZ today.
Thanks for having me on, Jesse. I really appreciate it.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.